of you that don't know of us, this is quite rare for us to be speaking at a conference like this. We're very particular about what we do, but we really wanted to get involved with Brilliant because I think this is a great agenda to really understand what markets are. For those of you that don't know me, I've actually been in the job for week number 7. I am the first employee of Martin Currie in Australia, and so setting up the Australian business and located in Melbourne. And really, well, yeah, Melbourne over Sydney, sorry about that, but the future fund's in Melbourne. Really, you know, what we're looking today is to really focus around the question of how we actually go about beating the market. And I think what you really need to understand and what we're going to try and focus on today is actually what the market is. And once you actually understand what the market is, you can then actually design a product and performance and process around that to actually beat the market. And I think what we're getting at here is that you need to think differently about beating the market, because if you think what the market does, you will never actually beat the market. And at the end of the day, that is really what we are employed to do. That is definitely not me. I'm a lot prettier than Andy Sowerby. Actually, Andy was meant to be here, but has just spent the last 36 hours at London Heathrow and could never make it to Australia, so I apologise for that. James is certainly going to be going through the presentation today, and I'll introduce James very, very shortly. But really, our thesis really focuses around one of the great investment greats, which is Benjamin Graham. And really, what Benjamin Graham was saying is that in the short run, it really is emotion and human factors that dominate. But in the long run, the market is dominated by facts, and fundamentals will always win out. And we see this every day at the moment with short-term noise and the amount of volatility that you're currently seeing in the market, not only on a daily factor, but actually in an intraday factor. What's great from our point of view, and especially thinking differently and being an active manager, is that this volatility and this noise actually creates enormous investment opportunities to actually beat the market. And I think all of you have seen the concept of efficient market hypothesis, read about it, probably studied it in university. And really, the argument is that the market is perfect. And as Ben Graham would say, the market is a weighing machine. It's been the cornerstone of investment thinking for many years. I hope this slide works, but we actually don't agree with this. And really, we don't think that the market is very efficient at all, because the efficient market hypothesis is basically telling you that everything is in the market. The market is rational. All factors are priced into the price of a particular stock or a particular market. And we actually believe that the market is driven by human behaviours. And in our form, that the market can be quite efficient, and especially efficient when there is a lot of noise that's located in the marketplace. These aren't my slides, by the way, so I apologise for some of these. But our thesis is that forget about the efficient market hypothesis and really concentrate on the thesis that it's an efficient employee hypothesis. And our starting point is actually the human, not the intangible market. And to beat the market, you actually need to fully understand what is the motivations of the individuals that actually exist within the marketplace. And James will shortly come on and talk about this. And our paper argues today that the market participant is driven by human basic instincts. And we all have these traits every day, whether it's in our working life or our social life. And this is what drives us, whether it's greed, etc., human interaction, human involvement, success. I can go on and on and on. In this interest, therefore, we need to understand how do these motivations change and what conflicts exist and where they exist. And in this case, it's our hypothetical portfolio manager in this picture is enjoying their lifestyle, or does it itself create an opportunity to actually exploit this? And one of the things we'll ask you and find out later on is which one do you believe by looking at this slide straight away? Who is the fund manager here? So that's about enough for me, and hopefully that gives you a very small introduction as to James's paper today. I've actually only known James for 6 weeks, but I've spent the whole week with him this week travelling around Australia. So he is a very good guy. So look after him today. But James has been with Martin Currie for over 24 years, and he's been managing global equities over that time. He is the current Chief Investment Officer of Martin Currie, Martin Currie, sorry, and also in charge of all our global equity platforms, which is currently around about $25 billion in Australian dollars. And our speciality is active management only and only in international equities. So we don't believe in bonds, we don't believe in property or anything like that. It is active management and equities in particular. James has designed an investment process, a team, and focused on this concept of behavioural finance. And I'll now hand over to James.
Thank you, Kimon.
These are definitely not my slides.
He was doing so well until he said that I was the current chief investment officer. I'm slightly wondering if he knows something already that I don't know. As Kimon said, time for something slightly different. Looking through the brochure, then this is a very different type of presentation to the one that you'll see elsewhere. And really success for me today in terms of what I'm going to talk you through is just to give you a bit of a different perspective. This is not something that you're going to walk out of here and do immediately, but hopefully it'll make you think a bit in terms of what's going on in the marketplace and your perspective around stocks, your perspective around products, your perspective around choosing a portfolio manager. And if I do that, then I've had some element of success. But anyway, as Kimon sort of inferred, welcome to the fund management community. The other thing I'm going to do, and I hate doing this, and I apologise for it, but it's about midnight my time, and I've had about 3 hours sleep, and if anybody knows Kimon, then you know one of the reasons why you get about 3 hours sleep when you're on the road here. So I'm going to spend time reading the presentation, which I hate doing, but I'll try and make it as interesting as I possibly can. But behavioural finance, it's an old study, and it's a very broad study. Adam Smith referred to aspects of what we would now refer to as behavioural finance as far back as the 18th century in his theory of moral sentiments, which obviously is the lesser known work, but it's one that really does focus on what today we would call behavioural finance. In the 20th century, Keynes and Benjamin Graham wrote extensively on the subject, so the concept is far from new. The surprise, perhaps, is how little it's invoked in the way that by the investment approach taken by managers, consultants, trustees, and the like. The breadth of the subject is significant, and it can involve the entire investment spectrum from forecasting, trading, company visiting, risk management, knowledge management, trading patterns, and holding duration, amongst other things. So the subject is absolutely enormous. In the time we've got, I'm going to concentrate on one aspect of the subject, as Kimon implied, the concept of the efficient employee. We'll look at some of the drivers behind the efficient employee and then try and draw some conclusions as to how processes can evolve to accommodate and address some of these pitfalls. Firstly, the efficient employee thesis is grounded in the recognition that markets are made and managed by people. An asset price, after all, is the sum total of everybody's interest in that particular asset. The efficient employee hypothesis recognises that once these views are established, it works, they draw an emotional reaction, creating a trend which in today's 24/7 marketplace get echoed beyond a local audience to a regional and then global reaction. The huge escalation in hedge funds in recent years ensures that the establishment of a trend happens quickly and is then magnified, no matter how woolly the concept. Sorry about the puns. As an aside, there is actually a sheep index, if you can believe it. And I've got the source of that, if Brilliant wants it. But there is a sheep index, and it's used in the US, and it measures conformity of managers, how likely managers are to move towards a trend. And the last time this was run, which was in 2004, it had 76% of institutions showed some form of sheep-like tendency, i.e. herd-like mentality. And therefore, the concept of the efficient employee really does rest around that. So, a trend becomes an emotion, subject to the vagaries of emotional response. A trend that appears money-making attracts significant amounts of human capital committed to the pursuit, and as valuations rise, justification of that trend. Language changes. New valuation measures are introduced and vociferously argued to justify escalating prices as the herd comes into line. Remember that during the tech bubble, the price-earnings ratio was rechristened. The PE became old-fashioned and inadequate for a new environment where growth was in the future and therefore required a forward aspirational matrix. If you remember, PE for companies like Yahoo became price per eyeball. Descriptive language changes as well. Paradigm. Watch out for this word. Escalating valuations are explained away by the reintroduction of the word paradigm. This word is never used out with a bubble period. Think about it. When did you ever use that word to describe the escalating price of steak? It's only brought out when no conventional explanation will work to explain valuations reaching nosebleed territory. Goldilocks. Perhaps subconsciously resort to fairy tales to help justify situations. The Goldilocks economy. It was only Goldilocks because it was indeed a fairy tale of an economy built in the concept of a new paradigm. But of course, as we may be seeing currently, emotions work in both ways. Changes in trends and emotional states, inflection points, are always underestimated in the extent and duration of their impact. So markets are driven by people, no matter how small. People have emotions and a need to communicate and conform. It is our paper's premise that a successful investment process reflects and understands emotional inputs into decision making. So having recognized the issue, how do you go about understanding the human psyche? Well, where better than to start with the grandfather of the study of human emotions, Freud. Freud divided the human psyche into three stages. The id. I've got to say, I didn't even know these terms existed until comparatively recently, but there you go, the id. The basic reactive instinct, the first one that all children are born with, and a reflection of an inability to put an emotional thought or need into a context. In the adult world, the id is something that comes out at a time of high stress, an irrational reaction where emotions take over from reason. In a stock market context, the point of ultimate capitulation, the purchase of SoftBank in Japan in 1999 on a PE multiple in the thousands, the sale of Nortel in Canada in early 2000 at $6 after a 99% fall in the stock price. Second stage is the ego. This, if you like, is the matured id, when comparison and rational thought is evoked calmly to assess a basic instinct. Brought about through training, conditioning, and increasingly the CFA course, it gives you the ability to make a rational judgment. Stage three, the superego. This is where fund managers live. The difference between humans and animals is our emotional state and the need to associate. Humans feel uncomfortable being alone, either physically or emotionally. It is very hard to be a contrarian, to go against the consensus, to be the English cricket supporter in Australia. The herd state is where most fund managers reside most of the time. The classic illustration of this aspect of our industry is the story of Tony Dye. Now, if you remember back to the late 1990s, the market was driven by a growth style. Value managers were old-fashioned geeks whose time had come in the new paradigm of price per eyeball. Tony Dye was Phillips and Drew Fund Manager's chief investment officer, and he had a reputation as being a leading fund manager, and in fact had built PDFM's business to one of the top five UK pension fund managers in the UK at that time. In 1996, he announced that the market was overvalued, shortly before somebody at the Fed did. However, unlike the Fed, he actually did something about it, holding out against the internet boom. PDFM were described as a joke by the Times newspaper as markets and valuations continued to soar. They lost a huge amount of assets, but still Dr. Doom, as he became known, refused to budge from his conviction that it would all end in tears. In March 2000, he was forced into early retirement. Within a month, the bubble had burst, and we all remember what happened next. The irony being that whilst hundreds of fund managers kept their jobs, having participated in the internet bubble, the man who stood out against it, the man who had the independence of mind and who was ultimately proved to be correct, paid the price and lost his job. But as Tony Dye put it, and to use Keynes's assessment, worldly wisdom teaches that it is better to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally. Tony Dye is a wonderful illustration of an investor, not an employee of the market. Pilloried and mocked by the investment community, his fundamental focus is an example to the modern fund manager. His focus on earnings over eyeballs is a classic teaching of behavioral finance and eventually proved correct. Incidentally, he went on to set up his own hedge fund And in 2004, he went against the market once again, calling the credit and housing boom an irrational bubble. This is the most difficult aspect of fund management. Neurologists have discovered that the pain of social exclusion is felt in the same part of the brain as actual physical pain. So a contrarian stance is akin to having your leg broken on a continual basis. Keynes recognized this, as indeed did Sir John Templeton, suggesting that superior performance is achievable only if a manager did something different from the crowd. We've not got the time here, but that really does raise questions around performance cycles and the veracity of benchmarks. Because if you think about it, the length of time it took for Tony Dye's thesis to work through. So these very broadly are the three psychic states. The challenge is that these stages are not sequential and can shift quickly and unpredictably. Indeed, at times of emotional stress, different facets of our character are exaggerated. One of the emotional tests we do in our recruitment process is to assess candidates under normal and stressful conditions. When I wrote this, I had a picture of Abu Ghraib in my mind, or putting fire underneath an employee. But we create a stressful environment and then ask them questions. And rational managers in a normal environment can change radically when the situation changes. A typical response is to protect oneself, and therefore individuality is lost as conformity asserts itself and we run for the herd. In a market context, underperformance tests resolve and the human emotional cycle takes over. This can be represented in three stages. Firstly, denial of the trend. Secondly, emotional withdrawal, recalcitrance, and a wee bit of pouting. And lastly, capitulation, and then a Damascene conversion. The alternative is to risk Tony Dye's fate, and it's the most basic self-preservation instinct. It's Behavioural Finance Rule 101. Let's have a look at some situational examples. I love this one. This is Bank of America. Analyst predictions are a subject worthy of a paper all on its own. In the 6th century BC, Lao Tzu, a Chinese philosopher, said, "Those with knowledge don't predict. Those who predict have no knowledge." Welcome to the analyst community. This slide is of the Bank of America over the course of the 12 months to July 2008 and a leading analyst call on the stock. The process works something along these lines. A fairly uncontroversial call is made to buy the stock. The stock doesn't do a great deal and then begins to fall. Initially, that's seen as an opportunity. Then, without the ground shifting too radically, the analyst begins to lose confidence and wants to withdraw below the parapet, changing his buy call to a hold. This period can last for some time, as you can see, from October last year through to about April this year. The market takes a turn for the worse. News flow begins to deteriorate. The analyst is stuck. He's anchored by his original in-price recommendation. But initially, he holds out. Stock price falls further. Client noise is rising, becoming absolutely intolerable. It's all he can think about. And with no further insight, he calls a sale, right at the point of capitulation. The reaction to that is that the market then bounces. The analyst has a Damascene conversion, and he says it's another opportunity to get out. And then he tries to find a job in the brewing sector. Last quarter ended September 30th this year. According to Bloomberg, analysts successfully predicted 6.7% of the S&P 500 results. And this in a day and age of very strict company guidance. Company visits and the role of insiders. Oh, here we go. Sorry. I forgot to build it. There you are. There you are. Company visits and the role of insiders. There is a significant debate as to the merits of seeing companies. Purists believe that nothing can be learned. Worse, that a company meeting will only serve to confirm an existing bias. At Martin Curry, we do believe in meeting companies. We see them as a source of learning about their businesses and their suppliers. However, there are a few classic pitfalls to be aware of. Firstly, it feels good to have your own views reflected back to you. Rarely do you question what you want to see or hear. An illustration of this I heard the other day, which I really enjoy because I see it happening every morning in my house. You get up in the morning, you go through to the bathroom, and you stand on the scales. If the scales tell you what you want to read, you smile and you get into the shower. If they don't, you get off and you get back on again. And in my household, you put your finger on the basin and then you get into the shower. The point being that we are naturally disposed to either agree with an investment that we've invested human capital into and equally ill-disposed to one we've sold. Secondly, don't listen to what is said in isolation. Think how it was presented to you. Thirdly, understand the basis of the discussion. So what is the role of insider? A director representing a company or something that you're considering investing into has a certain level of responsibility. In the UK, this is the Cadbury Code. And in short, it is the duty of a director to present an upbeat message about the outlook for that company. Accentuate the positive. We all do it. And as Kimon comes on to talking about Martin Curry in a moment or two, you'll hear him doing exactly the same. So, picture the scene. You visit with a company. The CEO is a great salesman. The business prospects sound absolutely wonderful. The stock must be cheap, probably at twice the price. You get a warm glow. But don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do. The natural conclusion to what we've been saying is the market isn't perfect, or necessarily even efficient in the short term. Rather, it is the physical manifestation of the behavioural and information failings that we all possess. To evidence this, here are the S&P 500 monthly returns since 1926. As you might see, these are not normal. Look at the tails. A normal standard deviation would not have the radical outliers you see here, where the market has moved 50% a month on occasion. Remember, this is the S&P 500. This isn't an emerging market index. To go further, Larry Summers, former US Treasury Secretary in the late 1980s, assessed the largest moves in the S&P and concluded that over 50% could not be ascribed to anything that could be considered fundamental. More recently, last weekend, New York Fed Chairman Gerald Corrigan sent a letter to Hank Paulson. And he said in this letter, the root cause of financial market excesses on both the upside and the downside of the cycle is collective human behavior, unbridled optimism, and fear bordering on panic. The key takeaway from this chart is that we're dealing with a marketplace here, not a stock university. So our thesis is that the market is driven in the short term by emotion, the needs for participants to conform, to achieve self-preservation, comfort, status, and frankly, it's an awful lot more fun to be an efficient employee than an efficient investor. Incidentally, it's the lady that's the fund manager. And an efficient employee, as Tony Dye illustrated, is significantly less vulnerable than an efficient investor. Another aspect of this, and I hesitate to go down this path, is the nature of fund manager remuneration, which again is a significant topic on its own. But as a taster, most fund managers are incentivized to be employees of the market, not investors. Fund managers are remunerated against assets under management. The quickest way to lose assets is to underperform. The easiest way to preserve assets is to closet index through an almost passive approach. And it's illustrated well by this slide. This is the US mutual fund industry since 1980. The index funds are the lowest line. The Scottish salmon pink represents stock pickers. The closet indexes represents the blue line. Stock pickers have been in almost terminal decline over the course of the last 20 years. What we look for at Martin Curry is investors, not expensive market employees. So, to pull things all together, how do you give the market the slip? Well, going right back to basics, the three R's. Recognize, realize, and remember. Firstly, be aware of the human aspects to investing, the pitfalls of anchoring and conformity. Secondly, be sensitive to the lower weighting given to judgment over knowledge and the tendency to hear only what you want to. And thirdly, as Mr. Buffett highlights, self-preservation dominates our industry. Finally, some thoughts on potential solutions. Firstly, consider the product. Reward conviction, skill and flair by removing artificial barriers. An unconstrained mandate creates a vehicle that encourages individual judgment rather than collective wisdom. The pursuit of alpha is enhanced when regional and sector weights are taken from the decision-making process. Secondly, ensure that the workplace is conducive to support an individual manager. To us, the ownership structure is a vital part of creating the right behaviours. Self-ownership aligns the interests of the portfolio manager with those of the client, absolutely. We have ownership as a central plank of our compensation structure. As a shareholder, I like to consider myself an investor and guard our own equity jealously, ensuring that new colleagues have a similar level of investment conviction, Kimon. Critical within the structure of a business is the culture, hugely fostered by ownership, but people management is a central core skill to ensure appropriate behaviours flourish and that underachievers are supported and coached to reach their goals. Thirdly, and critically, process. A focus on the real issues away from the noise. A dispassionate analytical structure grounded in uncontrovertible data but supportive of independent thought. A research structure avoiding the pitfalls of blind coverage and maintenance but emphasising the hunt for alpha-generating opportunities. And finally, risk management at the centre, considering client-driven factors and not index considerations. Kimon.
Well, hopefully in the last 25 minutes, that's sort of given you a feel of the way that we think we behave quite differently to the market and, you know, how I think at the end of the day, what you need to remember is that we're actually paid for that. We're not actually reimbursed to actually meet market expectations. The key here is to actually be better than the market. So I'd certainly like to open up the floor for any questions that you have. I thought I was doing that at the end. I'm quite fragile after James's talk now. I don't think I'm allowed to sell anything. Sorry, over here. Thank you. Yep.
I detect a complete minefield in this question.
I'm certainly not answering that question.
You know, and why aren't there more women involved in the funds management?
It gets worse, doesn't it?
I thought I might get Lorraine to answer that question.
Yes, I think that there is a gender bias in the way that analysts analyse, in the way that fund managers manage funds. I think there very evidently could be shown to be a link between a male approach and a female approach. In fact, in America, there is a sort of reverse discrimination in that there's a very, very successful asset management house on the West Coast which only employ women. And their track record is fantastic. They have done an exceptionally good job. And the turnover that they have in their portfolios equally is less. So you don't get the sort of macho broad bets, broad statements coming through in the portfolio within this particular house that I'm thinking of. And you don't get the trading activity. I bow to the female mind, but I think the female mind is significantly more convinced to stay with a story, to run with it, to understand it, and perhaps even to get more emotionally involved with it than a male mind, which is perhaps more of a trading mentality. But I think if I go much further, then I'm going to get myself into huge problems here.
Sorry? Help you identify those.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and absolutely right, because psychologically, once you've made a call in a stock, what you're actually is making a call on the valuation of the stock, but mentally you're thinking, oh God, I bought that at $20 as opposed to I bought that at this particular valuation. And almost you need to forget about the price as you go through time, because market conditions change and the valuation is really what you should be focusing on. And you sort of instinctively feel that only works on the downside, but it's also equally true on the upside. The classic environment is that a portfolio manager, male or female, will buy into a stock at $20. They see the stock going up to $30, they're wanting to take money out of it. They see it going up to $40, they're getting a nosebleed, and you're into uncharted territory. You've doubled your money, you're thinking of how much money you've made over your end price, and then you move out from it. What we do in order to be able to address that is that we have a numbers-based approach. And so what we're always looking to do is ground an investment opportunity in uncontrovertible data, and that's numbers. So we're always looking at the health of the balance sheet. We're always looking at the valuation of the company. We're always focusing on why we bought the company in the first place, which typically is earnings revisions. So you're looking for positive earnings revisions. And then you're comparing the valuation of the company against its market, against its sector. And by doing that, you stick with the story. Sticking with the beneficiaries of positive change. If you look at the mining sector over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, analysts, and understandably so, have hugely underestimated the movement in commodity prices, the movement in energy prices, on a consistent basis over the course of the last 5 to 6 years. It wasn't that long ago that oil was $10 a barrel, and now it peaked at 147. So you had analysts calling the top of this run on a consistent basis over that period of time. What we do is we just look at what the earnings are coming, what the earnings outlook is. We look at where the revisions are, and you stay with the story. And until those things change, forget about the price. The price will sort itself out. Just look at what's going on within it. On the downside, now you think how many times we've been told that the credit crisis has come to an end. And actually, everybody's trying to catch a falling knife in the financial sector. And again, we will miss the bottom in the financial sector, and I will guarantee that. But what we look for is actually something that's material coming through in the assessment of that particular company that gives you confidence that the bottom has been reached. And that is going to be something along the lines of an improvement in the housing market that comes through in the cessation of provisions, the ability to sort of ground earnings and so forth. So it's always grounding an investment argument against uncontrovertible data, and that data is typically numbers-based.
Any more questions?
Are we right for time?
Yeah, we're fine.
Oh, sorry?
There's a question over there. Can you give an example of one of your best and worst picks?
Thanks. One of the best picks... the best ever thing I did was I met with a guy from a company called D.A. Campbell. And I saw them because of the name Campbell, good Scottish house. But they actually sounded anything but Scottish, because they came out of Santa Monica. And they were recommending emerging market ADRs at the end of the 1980s. And the ADR that they were recommending was Telmex, Telefonos de México. And they were recommending it 19 cents on the dollar. And you always remember these sorts of things. This, I'm afraid, was 1988, which is the last time I really had a really good idea. But this particular stock, it was 19 cents, and they were talking about the rollout of telecommunications across Mexico. They were talking about the economic enfranchisement of the Mexicans and the opportunity that Telmex had. It was growing at 30, 40, 50% on a consistent basis. We didn't get in anything like the lowest price. The lowest price was something like 4 or 5 cents, and we got in at 19, and I think we sold it at $120 as the market just went sky high. And that took about 5 years to work through, but I remember that one very favourably. Things that we got wrong, we bought into a real estate company in Germany at the end of last year. I suspect this isn't... Actually, the entertaining one I got really wrong was we got into a private equity company in Hungary, and I can't remember the name of this particular one, but the franchise was to introduce Kentucky Fried Chicken into the new Central European states. And I thought this was a great idea. This was 1989, 1990. And if you went to Budapest, Warsaw, Prague, then it was like walking back 150, 200 years. No neon lights, no modern stores, very much the product of central planning. Hungary was the pharmaceutical center for the old USSR. And the concept that you could bring fast food into these places, I thought was fantastic. So Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise, well, we'll have a bit of that. So we supported that. And about a week after the thing was paid for, it became clear that the Hungarian government wouldn't allow the import of broiler chicken. So Kentucky Fried Chicken became Wendy's very quickly. And the Hungarians had a very different sweet tooth to Wendy's. And so it went bankrupt. So that was my worst ever one. It went to zero.
Everyone's stealing my thunder. Well, I think if this thing works properly.
Down. That's the down arrow.
We're stuck.
There you are.
Sorry, I didn't. I think before I answer that question, I mean, I'll get back to, you know, what we're really talking about here today is the sense that the way we view the world and the way we view markets. And going back to James's original response with the fact that you don't want to be constrained in this marketplace. So the way that we have developed our business and the product range that we have is we don't want to be constrained. We know there's a benchmark there, but we want to do everything that we can around that benchmark to actually create value for our clients. So in Australia, what we've done is launched the Martin Currie Global Alpha Fund AUD. The product went live on the 30th of April of this year. It does have a five-year track record behind it, which you'll see on the next slide, which answers your question in terms of how we've done in performance. But really, what we're looking at doing here is picking globally the best 30 to 45 names around the world over a universe of
7,000.
So there's a universe of about 7,000 companies that we can invest in, and we just want to invest in the top 45 maximum. There really is no benchmark. There is no sector or country limits. And on the stock weighting, we have a, you know, probably where we wouldn't call this an absolute return product because there is a stock limit of index plus 5, which is quite wide. So this is a sort of what I'd call a very high octane, very punchy product that if you are going to measure us against an index, which is the MSCI World, is probably index plus 4 to index plus 5 of our performance objective. And, you know, as James has talked about earlier, you know, the benchmark is a measure of success, but we certainly don't want to make it a barrier to the way that we go about investing money. So, you know, for us to meet the benchmark is certainly not us having a good year, so to speak. So we're certainly not remunerated against the benchmark, and we certainly don't expect our clients to pay us against that benchmark as well. So the other thing that's critical in this product is every stock that goes into this product is actually a conviction idea. So there is no underweight to the index in this product. Every stock is an active weight against the benchmark. So there are no fillers, so to speak, and you can't have that when you've got a very short list of only, you know, 30 to 45 names. So this is something that we believe the timing's right for this marketplace. It does have a very good track record. And getting back to your question, when you look at the performance over coming up now to a probably a 5.5 year cycle, you can see there the blue line is the MSCI World, XAUD, which so that's 5.5 years. So that's the blue line, which is the world index. Global Core, which is one of our other products, which is a little bit more constrained, is trying to do index plus 2. That's the performance it's had over its 5.5 year period. And Global Alpha, which is our flagship fund and what we've launched in the Australian marketplace, has done over that 5 year period 60%. So very good returns over a period when you're back to your question, extremely volatile and also in very, very different market conditions over the last 5.5 years. I don't know if you want to add anything to that. And I think that for us, that's what we're employed to do, is actually create that sort of alpha when you're looking at such a short stock list. So, you know, really we're putting very high conviction ideas into the portfolio and letting them run as best as we can. And as James said, even if the stock price does go up 50 or 60 or 100%, if we still believe that there's positive change within that individual company, we will let that ride and take the benefit of positive change in the marketplace. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah,
I don't know how to sell anymore after listening to your talk. We got time for...
Yeah, John, yeah. I was just wondering how you view currency and therefore hedging.
The way that... we've done it two ways. Over the course of the 1980s, 1990s, then we would take a currency view. And the one thing I learned about currency is it makes a mug of you all the time. And the other thing I learned about it is that whatever the hedge that you've got in, and we only ever hedged the assets that we had exposed to it, and we only ever hedged a maximum of 75% of that exposure, A, it was the biggest whiplash on the performance on a quarterly basis, and B, you became myopic about it. You know, I was watching every tick on the yen-dollar rate on a sort of minute-by-minute basis. So I thought there's got to be a better way of doing it. And actually, the logic of it is, your earnings assessment at a company level takes in the currency mix that's within the within the company into which you're investing. And so consequently, you could argue that if you're overlaying a company investment with a hedge, you're putting pig on pork. You're doing the same thing twice. And actually, if you believe that this company is going to earn X as a consequence of the mix of businesses that they've got, as a consequence of the currency exposure that they feel they've had, then why do otherwise? Stick with the company that you've got it, that you've invested into, rather than putting in a mechanism over and above it. So within the portfolio, we don't hedge now. We just let the companies do it for us.
Do you feel that, though, that might lead, say, from an Australian investment?
Well, we were talking about this yesterday, and in fact, the vehicle that we've got here has got a hedged version to it, or is going to have a hedged version to it as well.
It's basically what I would call a passive hedge that's run on a monthly basis at the end of each month. However, intra-month, if there's enough of a major inflow or outflow, we will actually hedge that at the end of the day.
Following on from the question about, the stock selection process, and most of this presentation today has been about the psychology of investing, and you mentioned about the noise out there in the market. I was just wondering, in regard to your stock selection, is there any methods other than kind of banning your stock pickers from reading the newspaper that you kind of keep them away from the noise, or is it just the bottom-up stock conviction, or yeah. Is there any methods you use to manage that process?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about what's happened over the course of the last 6 weeks, a classic illustration of sort of the winning out of noise over fact, we've seen a total flip-flop from what was running with markets over the course of the first 6-7 months of this year, which was being aware of economic slowdown, focusing on commodities, focusing on energy as obviously the commodity price and so forth, commodity prices on a broad basis move forward. And then what we saw, the flip side of that, was that you sold everything that was in the commodity space and moved into financials and consumer discretionary and had that run. Well, the noise around financials and consumer discretionary was on the basis of they finished their provisioning, economies are beginning to bottom out, that you're going to be able to see employment trends beginning to bottom out, that the housing market is beginning to look a bit better on a month-in, month-out basis. So that's the noise justifying the short-term trend. Our view on that is it just doesn't exist in the numbers. You know, you cannot put anything around the financial sector at the moment that says they're going to see a positive environment over the course of the next 3 to 6 months. You can't see anything in consumer discretionary. In Edinburgh, you follow a Lothian regional bus if you can catch up with it. And on the back of it is an advert for Fiat. And Fiat is actually is a very good company, and they've got the right car for the right market at the moment because they're small and they're fuel efficient. But they're saying that you can go and visit a Fiat forecourt, pick a Fiat, drive out with it and have nothing to pay for 12 months. And then on top of that, they'll give you free petrol for 12 months. So, you know, how are they paying for that? Where are they going to get margin in it? And why would they be doing that if the consumer was out there and hungry? So We looked at, absolutely didn't come into the numbers at all, and so consequently we stuck with our guns, which is that we stuck with the energy and selective resources names. So it's all about grounding in numbers.
I mean, I think, you know, particularly at this time, we're all sort of trying to deal with our own psychology around the market. So I think we've all have got something like that. We need to do a little bit of housekeeping before I ask John from Van Nuys to just wrap up this session with a quick summary. But before we do, can everyone put their smart card into their gizmo? And while I remember to say this, please leave this behind, the gizmo, when you leave. Okay. But has everyone got their smart card in? Because what we're going to do is to vote on this session so that we can get James back again later after lunch. So we can get James and Keemon back after lunch to do it all over again. So that's what we're voting on to help our other people who weren't here determine whether they should come or not. So everybody ready to go? So please cast your vote now based on those four criteria. Thank you.
Can you vote more than once?
Yeah, okay, you've got to be quick, yeah. Has everyone done that? Yep, everyone felt they did that?
Good.
Okay. Well, just to close the session, I'd like to ask John to give us a quick summary.
Sure.
Basically put together. Sorry. A good argument about how the efficient market hypothesis. Basically, there's some limitation to how it can be applied, and with the market driven by basically its participants, you have to be aware of the pitfalls of the more traditional conventional hypothesis. So, and with the with the benchmark that they have been raised as a guidance for your portfolio construction, I mean, there's definitely some ground for using that as a one of the tools to look at your portfolio, but it shouldn't be used as a total dictator for your overall portfolio construction. So I think that's my brief comments.
Right. Thank you, John. Well, on behalf of all of us, thanks again to James and Keemon. Thanks. It's now time for lunch, and I think you're back here just after 2. Just check the program, and there'll be an announcement of the best sessions to go to during the lunch break.
Thanks for turning up. Thanks, John. Kind words.